Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. This has been a momentous week for the issue of designer babies. In Britain, a judge has ruled that the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, which governs the use of reproductive technology in England, has to consider again the ethics of parents using tissue typing to determine which embryos should be implanted when they go for an in vitro fertilization for fertility treatment. They use this technology in some cases to create a child that has the same tissues as another sibling so that they can provide a tissue transplant, so that they're closely related to their sibling. And this has now been ruled to be, in England at least, a designer baby practice and therefore prima facie unethical and has to go back for review. Also this week, the Raelian sect has announced that they will be bringing us a clone by Christmas. So this week we're talking to Kathy Hudson, and she has recently conducted a survey of public American attitudes towards genetics and reproductive technology. Kathy Hudson is the director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, which can be found at dnapolicy.org. She's the former assistant director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, and she has a PhD in molecular biology from the University of California. Welcome, Kathy.
Good day.
And I'm very excited about the survey that you've done, and you, I understand, are the director of this center because you founded it. You weren't hired as a director. You went out and you started this center, so you obviously have a strong commitment to the goal of educating the public about genetics. And the survey that you have done is about the public's understanding and attitudes towards genetics that we want to talk about today. What was the title of the survey?
We were assessing public's knowledge and attitudes about reproductive genetic technologies.
Mm-hmm. Now, you found, in terms of the knowledge, you found that there isn't very much knowledge out there, which I always remember a survey that was done back in 1984, which asked Americans whether they supported the U.S. policies in Central America, and then it asked whether they knew what they were, and it turned out only about a quarter of them knew what they were. So this is one of those cases where Americans have lots of opinions about this but don't really know what they're talking about, isn't it?
Well, certainly the public's knowledge is mixed. On some of the questions that we ask about genetic testing, the public scored reasonably well, but overall the public's knowledge, I guess if I were to give them a grade, would probably be about a C. What's interesting is that the public's knowledge about genetic technologies overall and their application to human reproduction has not really changed over the last 10 years or so. So in looking at comparable data from previous surveys, there really hasn't been an increase in the public's knowledge. Meanwhile, our scientific understanding of the human genome and the human genetic contribution to health and disease has grown exponentially. So clearly the public's information about these topics is not keeping pace.
You said in the survey that only 18% of the respondents were able to correctly answer six or of the eight knowledge questions.
That's
so
right.
Can you give us an example of what those knowledge questions were?
I can. So we asked folks whether or not it's scientifically possible today to perform a genetic test to detect risk for cancer in the future. And in fact, that was the question that most respondents did the best on. 72% of the respondents got that question right. We also asked slightly more difficult questions. Are genetic tests available to detect the risk for mental illness? No such test is available. The public didn't score very well on that, only 21% getting the answer correct. And then we had more focused questions on the application of genetic technology to reproduction, whether or not prenatal genetic testing is available for serious genetic diseases, whether or not prenatal genetic tests can be performed to detect behavioral or physical attributes not related to disease in a fetus during pregnancy.
To be fair to most of the respondents, very few of them said that they had thought very much about these issues. Only 15% said they'd thought a lot about them, and only 58% said they thought some or a lot.
That's right. Now, the awareness, we ask both awareness questions and then ask them to gauge how much they thought about them. And not surprisingly, the genetic technology that most people were most familiar with was human cloning, and certainly that's because it's in the headlines every day. And then the awareness of technologies dropped fairly precipitously after that, with only 24% of the respondents being aware that there is a technology called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis that allows genetic testing to be performed on an embryo even before initiating a pregnancy.
Now, some of the commentators about your survey have connected this lack of knowledge to the fact that 22% of your respondents said they believed that a human had already been cloned. And that doesn't necessarily connect for me, because I think that a lot of people assume that that some kinds of genetic therapies, such as cloning, which are highly controversial, are being done in secret because they, you know, there are a lot of secrets in the world.
That's right. We asked people whether or not they believed it was scientifically possible today to clone an animal such as a cow or a sheep, and that has been done, and most people knew about it. We asked people whether or not it was possible to clone a human being today, and about half believed that it was possible, and about half of those, or 22%, believe it has already happened. This is interesting in light of the fact that there has been a lot of news about claims being made by a couple of groups that they do have pregnancies underway with human clones, but there's been no demonstrated evidence of that, and many in the scientific community are highly suspicious of the veracity of these particular claims.
The Raelians are promising to give us a clone for Christmas.
That's right.
Now, speaking of the Raelians, a third of the population in your survey were serious, hardcore, what I would refer to as bio-Luddites. They were opposed to a lot of the technologies that you proposed. Although you point out that only 5% were opposed to all, what was it, 12 technologies mm-hmm. that you mentioned. But mm-hmm. So 5% opposed to everything, 2% in favor of everything, and everybody else in between someplace. But about a third were pretty serious opposition. And almost all of those, wouldn't it be fair to say, were religious?
Well, we did find a correlation between those people who describe themselves as viewing these technologies primarily in terms of religion and morality and caution or lack of enthusiasm for these technologies overall. And it also turned out that that group was more likely to hold their views most strongly. So the folks who view these technologies in terms of health and safety are more supportive, but less likely to hold those views particularly strongly.
But also, one-third of your sample were evangelical Christians, so
that's right.
I assume there's a pretty strong overlap between that evangelical group and the group that was opposed to most things.
Interestingly, not a perfect correlation at all. So there are, and I'm not going to be able to pull the number out of my hat, but about half of the evangelical Christians are putting themselves into that religion and morality category. Thus, many of the people who principally view these technologies through a moral lens are coming from non-evangelical Christian groups.
I was surprised to see that you had, in your survey, I'm not criticizing your methodology at all, but you had 9% who were atheist, agnostic, or no religion, and it's a little bit higher than I see in most surveys of this kind. But at any rate, you found that gender was one of the principal predictors of whether people ended up on the techno-libertarian end of the spectrum or the bio-Luddite end of the spectrum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We, in terms of asking whether or not individuals approved of various applications of genetic technology, primarily in the reproductive context, we found very strong approval both among men and women for those health-related applications, so using these technologies to avoid having serious genetic disease in a child, strong support for in vitro fertilization about equal between men and women. But when we moved into categories, largely hypothetical categories, of using genetic technology to select for desirable traits, such as IQ or physical appearance or specific behavioral characteristics, there was a strong difference between the approval of men and women. And in the strongest difference was on reproductive cloning, where still overwhelmingly the public disapproves of human reproductive cloning, but of those who approve, men are twice as likely as women to approve. So 26% of the men approved of this technology, this application, while only 11% of women approve of this. So more than a twofold difference between men and women's views there.
That was very interesting to me because in general you find that women are more supportive of abortion rights than men. And because of the reproductive rights movement over the last 20, 30 years, I would have expected that that would have carried over, at least it does for me, carry over into the logic of women being allowed to control their own bodies in terms of these decisions as well. But it seems that men are maybe more pronatal, but they believe in quality control, and women believe that they should be able to determine whether to have a child or not, but that they should love any child that comes along, or more likely to believe they should love any child that comes along uniformly.
Yeah, I don't know whether or not the connection for people, because this is a sort of an initial glimpse at public attitudes, I'm not sure whether or not the difference between men and women is more linked to their values around reproduction and their values around family and children, or whether or not it's more of an aspect of how they view technology overall. And so that'll be interesting to explore. We're launching now a large number of focus groups and various kinds of interviews with subgroups in the American public to try to ask the question, what's underlying these particular attitudes and views? And so that'll be interesting to explore in groups of men and women. The difference in the support of the non-health-related applications with men was most pronounced among young men. So men between 18 and 29 were the strongest supporters of these non-health-related applications.
This is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. Jay. We're talking today with Kathy Hudson. She's the director of the Genetics and Policy Center in Washington, D.C., which can be found at dnapolicy.org. And they recently conducted a large national survey of attitudes towards designer babies as a catch-all category, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
The secular motivations for technophobia are more interesting to me in some ways than the religious ones, because the religious ones you can't really argue with very much. If one person says that wearing a condom is playing God and another person doesn't, well, where do you go with that? But in terms of some of the secular motivations, and it gets back to what you were saying about science, it seems like underlying a lot of people's concerns about reproductive technology is their fear of scientific arrogance and their sense that these technologies may create a more powerlessness for them and their kind in the future. And men probably feel more empowered vis-a-vis technology and the directions technology will go than women do.
Yeah, we didn't ask questions directly on that point in the survey, although we certainly did ask whether or not what people viewed as the primary benefit and the primary concern raised by these technologies. And I think that in the primary concern area, we asked the question whether or not using these technologies is too much like playing God, and percentage of our respondents indicated that that was their number one concern, while almost an equal number indicated that they were concerned about these being used for the wrong purposes. So I think that there's a strong underlying sense that that technology is sort of value neutral, and it's how it's applied that people are concerned about, and sort of a degree of caution about are there going to be appropriate limits for the use of these technologies, and who's going to set those limits, and how are those lines going to be drawn.
One of the things that didn't get much coverage in your survey, in the public reporting about your survey, that I found quite startling, in terms of bioethics, we talk a lot about the difference between enhancement and germline engineering on the one hand, and then corrective genetic therapy on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked the question, would you approve or disapprove if parents were offered a way to change their own genes in order to prevent their children from having a genetic disease? And you found that 60% were in support of that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas among bioethicists, there are all these bioethicists who will stand on their head to argue that germline engineering should be absolutely forbidden.
That's right. And there's also a strong difference of views even among the faith-based community about where one would, how one views permanently, in a heritable way, making changes to the human genome. But in our survey, there was a strong support for that. And again, the question was phrased in a way of making clear a benefit. So it'll be interesting to explore that in more detail when people are given more information and are able to make a more sort of informed, reflected evaluation of that specific question.
Yeah, but one of the things about your question that I think is interesting is the choice to put in bold your own genes.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, this is one of the critical issues, that many people will support all of our rights to control our own bodies. And so when push comes to shove, the question is whether our right to control our own bodies trumps other people's concerns about the future of genetic patrimony or whatever.
That's right. I think there's a significant concern about if one were able to add a gene or change a gene in a particular human being in such a way that it is heritable, that it's transmitted to subsequent generations. I think there's some caution because of the unknown potential consequences of that change, but there's also a concern that that's then modifying the genetic composition of future generations and in some way violating the autonomy of that individual to decide whether or not they want that particular gene added or not.
Now, to push the point even further, you had a question which was about germline enhancement, which of all of the bioethical conundrums, the one that has the fewest supporters. And the question was, would you approve or disapprove if parents were offered a way to change their own genes in order to have children who would be smarter, stronger, or better looking? And, of course, far fewer people were supportive of this. But something that I didn't see mentioned was that you showed what the support was in 1994, which was 10% said yes to that, and now it's 20%.
That's right.
So there is a natural history to these questions. I mean, if we look back at in vitro fertilization, if we look back at the public response to organ transplantation, there's an initial yuck factor, shock of the future kind of thing. And then people get used to the idea as tangible medical benefits become apparent.
That's right. I think that's the part of this is the lack of familiarity. So certainly when IVF was new, when we didn't have a neighbor who had a child, an IVF baby, it was more unfamiliar and thus less accepted in general. And the acceptance now of in vitro fertilization is very, very high, going up steadily, as has the frequency of in vitro fertilization, where now nearly 1% of all the babies born in the country are IVF babies. And so this is something that we're all familiar with. The genetic engineering is certainly something that most people have not had a personal encounter with, and so it is something that's foreign and thus potentially a little scary. But the distinction here is we did ask about genetic engineering to avoid disease and genetic engineering to create desirable traits, and there was a majority approving of genetic engineering to avoid disease, so a health-related medical application. And a very small percentage in the 20% range supporting genetic engineering to create desirable traits. Now, it's important that I point out that this is not possible today. It's only a theoretical possibility that we'd be able to identify the genes that are contributors to complex human characteristics. And even if we knew those genetic contributions, they wouldn't be the whole answer, because complex human characteristics are not the result of simply the sum of our genes, but the result of complex interactions between many, many genes and many really infinitely more complex environmental variables.
But it seems likely that we'll be able to find among those genes, among those proteins, individual cases where increasing the production of a certain neurotransmitter may jack up intelligence 15%. So, you know, even though people say that these are very complex therapeutic interventions and that extending the life expectancy will be a complex endeavor, we may be able to find that one protein which is released when there's caloric restriction. And if we just jack that up in the genome, we could have another 20 years of life.
Well, on the intelligence side of things, there have been researchers who have explored this question, and there are particular genes, particular genetic loci that have been correlated with how one scores on a standardized IQ test. But the contribution of those particular genes is very, very modest. So it's only altering performance on an IQ test a couple of points. So it's not going to be a large shift from any specific genetic contribution. But yes, we will undoubtedly find genetic contributors to a whole range of non-disease-related aspects of humanness, and how those genetic tests and technologies and information are used, I think, are of strong concern to many.
I know that the purpose of your center is nonpartisan. I don't want to get you in trouble necessarily unless you're willing to go there. Leon Cass, one of the most conservative bioethicists in the country, basically a practitioner of 13th century bioethics, has put his strong stamp on the president's bioethics commission, and he is the most articulate exponent of a view of ethics that people's gut reactions, uneducated gut reactions to everything, should be the drivers of public policy, which, as many point out, would have kept Rosa Parks at the back of the bus. How do you feel about yuck factor ethics, if you're willing to address that topic?
The so-called wisdom of repugnance.
Right. I mean, your survey kind of feeds into this in that we're taking a snapshot of how people feel right now, and a lot of people feel some repugnance. But does that necessarily inform the ethical debate?
I think that it is important to take into account where the public is on these issues and what they feel is appropriate and inappropriate uses. You mentioned the uneducated public, and I think that while we would all encourage that the public know more about the science of genetics, certainly those of us who have spent our professional lives in this area would encourage more public education and information about genetics. But there's a level at which you sort of need to sort of step back and say, well, what's important for the public to know in order to make moral value judgments about the use of these technologies? And you know, the example that I like to use, because I'm while I know genetic technology very well, I don't know computer technology particularly well, and I don't feel like I need to understand everything about how my computer works in order to make value judgments about the use of computer technology. So I think that there's a line, you know, that sometimes we get a little too enthusiastic about making sure that the public really understands every dot and tittle of a particular technology before they can be deemed to be meaningful contributors to the public debate. And I think that's probably not, you know, that's an overzealous approach to public engagement. I think that there are now and are likely to continue to be deeply, deeply held views that will cause people to be in strong opposition to many of these applications, and that those views will need to be considered in the development of policy, both policy towards the that guides the research that's being conducted, policy that guides the clinical application of these technologies, and then public policy and how they're used in society and by societal institutions.
Very well said and framed. I'm speaking today with Kathy Hudson. She's the director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, which can be found at dnapolicy.org. I'm Dr. J, and this is Change Surfer Radio. One of the other things that you ask about in your survey is the public's attitude towards regulation. You find that a majority of Americans think that these technologies should be regulated, although there is that 10% out there who said that absolutely nothing should be regulated, which was a surprise to me. I didn't know that there would even be 10% who would say that this shouldn't be regulated. I mean, everything is regulated. I mean, I'm for regulation personally. The question is, what kind of regulation and for what reason? So I was a little surprised by this kind of blanket question about regulation, because you can have regulation for safety and efficacy, or you can have regulation that says you have Islamic Sharia as regulation. And I don't see this question necessarily makes a distinction between those two.
Well, in all of the questions except regarding cloning technology, we specifically said, do you believe the government should regulate the safety and efficacy of the technology? So we weren't we did limit, to some extent, the questions. We weren't asking a broad regulate for any purpose or to any end whatsoever. We were specifically asking about safety and efficacy. And I think more than getting at what kind of regulation and to what end the public would support, it more gets at the belief that the government should have a role in guiding these technologies as they develop in their application, and also a perception that the government should be taking care of us, that the government should have a hand in sort of guiding and directing the future of these technologies to protect the American public. It is very clear that the respondents to our survey didn't really know whether or not the government is currently regulating these technologies, and that's quite understandable because the regulatory framework for most of these is a patchwork that's very fragmented, and so it's a rather complex mix of a little bit of regulation from here and a little bit of regulation from there. We will certainly be exploring this in more detail, and as we develop our policy options for ways to regulate the safety and efficacy, and more broadly, these technologies, we'll be gauging the public's response to these specific options to see which are most palatable and to whom and why.
We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to address a cognate question, which is that your survey asked about the approval or disapproval of some of these technologies. And do you think that necessarily all those who said that they would disapprove of the technology would also go on to say it should be banned and no one should have access to it?
That's a fascinating question. So this, we did not get at that. There are very, there have been surveys done, particularly in the reproductive arena, where people are asked, do you approve of something? Would you do something? And do you think it should be permitted for others? And there are big differences in the answers to those subtly differently worded questions. The other thing is that if you ask people whether or not they would use a particular technology, that's not necessarily indicative of the reality of what those people would do when they're faced with the situation. So when a genetic test was first being developed for Huntington's disease, for example, there were studies conducted of people who had a strong genetic risk factor for developing, for inheriting the gene mutation that causes Huntington's disease. And they were asked, when this test comes along, do you want it? And there was a high percentage of people who said, yes, I'd absolutely want to have this genetic test to know whether or not I carried that gene mutation. And when the test was actually made available, the uptake, the number of people who actually wanted the test, was far, far, far below what had been predicted by those initial surveys. So I think how one responds when they're in the reality facing a real choice about genetics and its application to their lives and how they're going to respond to it, it may be very different than when it's a hypothetical question posed to them.
Dr. Hudson, I just want to point out again that the folks can read the survey report at dnapolicy.org. You have the methodology up there and the full frequencies and as well as your analysis of it. What's your next project?
We are starting with some more in-depth social science research to get at the whys and wherefores underneath these this initial pulse-taking that we saw in this survey. And we're also undertaking a considerable amount of policy analysis to set up the framework for the development of our policy options on reproductive genetic technologies.
Great. Well, I really appreciate your coming on board to talk with us today about this, and hope that you have much success in the future.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.